I'm Kate.
And I'm Tolly.
And welcome to Wicked Within. This week, we are back with another true crime case, and it's our 97th episode, so we're rapidly approaching episode 100, which is very exciting.
Woo!
Woo! Okay. Yeah, without further ado, let's just dive on in. On January 18th, 2020, 27-year-old Sasha Krause disappeared from her small community in Farmington, New Mexico. Sasha was not the kind of person to disappear without warning. She was a devoted Mennonite who loved her faith and her community. So why had she suddenly disappeared? And even more importantly, who was responsible for her disappearance? Before we learn more about Sasha and the timeline of her disappearance, I'm going to do a mini dive into the Mennonites and their beliefs because it's going to be important in this story. Also, do you know very much about Mennonites?
I want to say I've definitely heard of them, but I think I get them confused with like
the Amish.
The Amish, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or like they're the same to me. And I feel like that's insensitive if I say it's the same. They're the same.
I don't know if it's necessarily insensitive so much as just like not accurate. Yeah. just inaccurate. Yeah. So, yeah, we are going to learn a little bit more. And I think it will help you to kind of like see the difference between, you know, a typical like Mennonite community and an Amish community. Although I will say that you are not the only one to confuse the two. I think I even mentioned the Amish later in my description. So,
okay.
That's a very common thought process. All right. So the Mennonite church developed during the Radical Reformation in 16th century Europe. In the early years of the new Protestant denomination, the Mennonites were persecuted, and these persecutions led the Mennonites to form tight-knit communities with strict rules that still persist today. If you happen to see a Mennonite in the wild, you might mistake them, particularly the women, as Amish. So there it is. The women tend to wear longer, more traditionally styled prairie dresses with long sleeves and high collars, though some may opt for long sleeve shirts and long dresses. Women are also expected to have their hair up, and they wear sort of like head coverings while out in public.
Head coverings, like the, like, I'm thinking pilgrimy.
Yeah, like not white like
bonnet or something.
Yes, more like a bonnet, not like a pilgrim hat. Yeah, they don't wear
not like a handmaid's tail hat.
Yeah, yes. No, they wear no, it would be kind of like something that like they would wear their hair back in like a bun and then they would have like a little head, a little white head covering that would kind of cover their bun and like a little bit of the like the crown of their head.
Okay, so yes. Bun.
Yep.
Tight.
Yep, fully. Okay. Mm-hmm. Men will also dress in more traditional style clothing, though they may be less noticeable at a glance than the women. Mennonites still tend to live in communities and are hardworking, pious, kind, and helpful. Unlike some of the other close-knit religious communities, many Mennonites welcome visitors and invite people to join them for church services. Mennonites have a strict foundation of love and non-resistance, which means that they will not fight back if provoked or attacked.
Really? It's,
yes, very much a turn-the-other-cheek kind of a culture.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Again, that will be important. Yeah.
Okay.
They formed an emergency relief committee for national and international aid in 1725, and that committee is still active today. Mennonites tend to live simple lives and can still be found on farms throughout the U.S. and Canada, but they also tend to be well-educated. Each Mennonite community is also able to determine their own rules for interacting with the modern world. So I think I might have even seen some Mennonites on, like, TikTok and Instagram. So some communities are like, yeah, we're okay with you having cell phones. You can maybe have like a little bit of computer and like what you can do with those things may be limited, but it's not as closed off again as like an Amish community where you wouldn't be using like, you know, a phone on the regular basis or anything like that. They have So it's kind of like they have these modern amenities, but they also tend to tap into like more traditional ways of doing things and being. So, yeah.
I find that super interesting that the individual communities have the ability to like choose access to technology. And that makes it even more confusing for people who just like come across them. Like, I thought you couldn't, like, if they happen to have other connections to like Mennonite communities, Just not the same across the board.
No. So with all that in mind, it's time to learn a little bit more about Sasha. Sasha was born on April 8th, 1992 in Temple, Texas. Sasha is one of six siblings, and when her parents joined the Mennonite faith when she was 11 years old, Sasha fully embraced the community and never looked back. As an adult, Sasha taught Sunday school for 6 years at Grandview Gospel Fellowship in Grandview, Texas, before she decided to move to another Mennonite community in Farmington, New Mexico, called Lamp and Light. Sasha was an avid reader and writer. She journaled and wrote music and poetry, including hymns that were sung at her church. Aww. Sasha, yep, she was actually quite good too. Sasha was also fluent in three languages and worked as a publisher at the Lamp and Light Publishing House. She spent a good portion of her workday translating religious texts, and she loved her job because it helped her to spread the word of God in her own way. Sasha lived with a couple of other unmarried Mennonite women in their 20s. The trio were all devoted to their faith and seemed to get along well. Sasha had her own car and a flip phone, and she was diligent about answering calls and texts as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we're going to explore the timeline of events leading up to Sasha's disappearance. On Saturday, January 18th, 2020, Sasha had dinner with her roommates before driving her car over to the church to collect some books for a Bible study. Sasha was planning on leaving early the next morning so that she could make a scheduled trip to Colorado to lead a Sunday school class, and she wanted to be prepared. She left her house at around 7 p.m. that evening. So you can find the names of Sasha's roommates online and in TV specials on this case, but I have chosen to change their names because they value their privacy and they're not pertinent necessarily to the overall story here. So Bethany, one of Sasha's roommates, awoke at 1 a.m. on January 19th and noticed that Sasha's door was ajar and her light was on. Bethany knew that Sasha had planned an early departure, and it was unusual for Sasha to be awake late at night. So Bethany went to her room to see if anything was wrong. But Sasha wasn't in her room. Bethany quietly searched the rest of their apartment, but Sasha was nowhere to be found. So she texted their other roommate, Elsie, to see if she knew where Sasha was. Elsie awoke to the sound of her text notification, and when she read the message, she rushed out of her room to speak with Bethany. They were both concerned about Sasha. Their community had a 10 p.m. curfew, and even if Sasha was having a difficult time going to sleep, they didn't think that she would break the rules. Sasha always had her phone on, so they tried to call her, but the phone went straight to voicemail, which was also highly unusual. In a last desperate attempt to find their roommate, Bethany and Elsie decided to check the church. When the roommates arrived at the church, they found Sasha's car with the doors unlocked and her keys inside, but there was no sign of Sasha. Bethany and Elsie knew that they had already pushed their curfew to the limit, so they decided to call Sasha's supervisor from the publishing house to let him know what was happening. When he heard that Sasha was missing, her supervisor was immediately alarmed, and he called several of the church elders to help him look for Sasha. But an extensive 2-hour-long search revealed no sign of the missing 27-year-old, so they decided to call the police. The San Juan County Sheriff's Office sent an officer to the scene immediately. He searched Sasha's car and her room on the compound. Church elders noted that several books were missing from the church, which seemed to indicate that Sasha had made it inside the church, but something must have happened before she could return home. Sasha had left her purse at home when she went to the church that evening, which meant that she didn't have any cash or debit cards on hand when she disappeared. Investigators also found pages and pages of poetry, scriptures, and journal entries, but nothing seemed suspicious, and there were no clues that seemed to indicate that Sasha felt unsafe or in danger. The only thing that was missing was Sasha's cell phone and Sasha herself. When questioned, church elders told the officers that Sasha was stable, reliable, and sensible, and the officers were clearly troubled by the mysterious disappearance. Mm-hmm. This was one of those cases where they were immediately like, no, this actually doesn't seem like just an adult wandering off and starting a new life. Obviously, they considered that as an option, but since she, again, didn't have
she
credit
just has
cards.
So many like strong ties to the community.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Like she's definitely not one that would like
no
truly be like, well, she could have just gotten tired of this because she was just so, it sounded like she was just so involved.
She was super
involved. And was happy.
Yeah. And I truly believe that she was. So it's good that they took it seriously right away. Again, they did cover their bases, but even if they ruled out the emotional ties, the fact that she didn't have her purse or, you know, credit cards, debit cards, cash, anything like that, made it even less likely that she was just going to be leaving in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Police also notified Sasha's family in Texas. They asked her family if she had any reason to leave the Faith or the Lampen Lake compound, but her family echoed the sentiments from the elders in New Mexico, saying that Sasha was well-liked, respectful, and loved her faith and her community. Over the next few days, the search efforts continued to ramp up. The Farmington area is quite rural, so there was a lot of land to be covered, but even with the assistance of volunteers, canine units, and helicopters, Sasha was still a missing person. So by this point, pretty early on, it seemed clear to everyone that Sasha did not leave of her own accord, but there were no obvious suspects, at least not at first. But then Elsie told officers that Bethany and Sasha had had difficulties in the past.
Elsie, this is news to me.
Yes, and indeed it is. I think it was news to pretty much everyone except for Elsie. So Elsie suspected that Bethany was interested in one of Sasha's co-workers, and she was jealous of their friendly relationship. Without any other leads, officers decided that they needed to question Bethany in more depth, so she was brought down to the sheriff's office. Bethany admitted that she and Sasha had had a difficult relationship in the past, but they had resolved their issues. Bethany also gave a voluntary DNA test, though at that point there was no evidence to compare it against. Officers thought that Bethany seemed secretive and a bit suspicious, but they didn't have probable cause to hold her, so she was allowed to return to her community. In further interviews with members of the Lampen Lake community, officers learned that there was some discomfort with John and Anita Lapping, who lived in a house on a hill above the compound. Many people, particularly the Mennonite women, said that the Lappings were nosy and would watch them with binoculars.
Oh, they were not part of the Mennonite community.
They were not. No, they were just their neighbors who lived on the hill above them.
Okay.
They were even more troubled when the Lappings installed numerous surveillance cameras over their property. The community felt as though they were being spied on, though when the Lappings were asked about their substantial security system, they told the officers that the cameras had been installed so that they could spot wildlife. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, here's the thing. A lot of people do that. People will put up, like, wildlife cameras, and, you know, for hunting or for, I don't know, you know,
when bird watching. When I think of watching. That, though, I think of, like, the hidden type that are, like, in trees, like, out in the forests or on the floor under the, like, leaves or something.
Yeah.
Not,
yeah,
like, true security cameras.
That is, I fully agree.
Specifically looking towards the community. Like, that's where it's weird.
I agree. Here's my thing. Well, I wouldn't be wild about my neighbors installing 1,000 cameras all over the place. I wouldn't necessarily think it's weird unless I could specifically prove that they were aimed to watch me and my property. There are a lot of paranoid people, I guess you could say security conscious people, including myself. And I don't think it's that odd that people would keep a zillion eyes on their property, because I know that people do that. But the fact that they said that it was for wildlife spotting rather than security spotting leads me to believe that there was at least some accuracy in the Mennonites' discomfort about being watched.
At minimum discomfort, like maybe not full on like fear or paranoia, but at least enough to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think that's reasonable.
I think so too. I also wonder if, like, you know, I think sometimes we assume that like our neighbors are weird because we don't understand them. Or like, I know that people can end up having like weird beef with their neighbors and they feel like they are single-handedly like responsible for watching their neighbors like every move. Like it's going to turn into like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. It's going to be like Rear Window and they're going to spot their neighbors committing a murder. Yeah, exactly. But, and I'm not necessarily saying that the Lappings were doing that, but I think that they probably are maybe even like maybe a little nosy, a little bit curious even, you know, I guess they were like, well, I can just be a fly on a wall in a Mennonite community just to see what they're doing in the day. I have no idea. I do think it's a little bit weird, but it's not on its own. It's not enough to, you know, have them arrested. So,
I mean, it questioned.
Questioned for sure. And they were, but not enough to hold them at all. Yeah. And then we have Samuel Kuhn, who may have been the last person to see Sasha alive. Samuel worked with Sasha at the publishing house, and he stopped by the church on the night of her disappearance. Though, he told officers that he didn't see her there that evening. Samuel told officers that he parked outside the church, walked in to grab a cooler, and then drove to the gas station with his wife so that they could have a full tank of gas the next morning. When Kuhn was asked to repeat his story, he told officers that he entered through a different door than was mentioned in the original statement. CCTV footage from the gas station was retrieved, and it showed that Kuhn was at the gas station at around the time that he said that he was there, but they couldn't confirm that his wife was with him. In a separate interview, Kuhn's wife said that she was with her husband most of the day and night, and that the only time that he left her side was when he went out to join the search for Sarah at 4 a.m. on January 19th. Of course, it's not uncommon for spouses to lie when their spouse is under suspicion of kidnapping, and Kuhn refused to take a polygraph test, which was unusual, especially given his Mennonite beliefs. Nevertheless, there wasn't enough evidence to arrest him, so he remained a free man. Though, again, they did question him. 5 weeks passed without any sign of Sasha Kraus, but then, on February 21st, park rangers received a concerning call from a woman camping at Sunset Crater... This is a really long name, sorry. Sunset Crater Volcano National Monument, about 30 minutes outside of Flagstaff, Arizona.
That was very long.
It really was. I'm used to like Crater Lake, and then you can just call it Crater Lake. You don't have to say Crater Lake National Park. It's Sunset Crater Volcano. Just a lot of words that I don't expect to be following one another.
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So when rangers went to the scene and confirmed the presence of a dead young woman, they called in a detective from Coconino County. Detective Lauren Nagel was assigned to the case. The young woman was lying face down and dressed in a long gray dress and a white jacket. Her hair was neatly styled and her body was in good condition, likely due to the cold, dry mountain air and the shade provided by a large sagebrush bush located next to her body. When they turned her over, they realized that the young woman's hands had been bound together with tape, and they quickly realized that they weren't dealing with a suicide or an accidental death. Because typically speaking, people are not going to duct tape their hands together. No.
Not themselves. Not normally.
No. Not normally. I have a lot of time for Detective Nagel and the other investigators at the Coconino Sheriff's Office because this case was very well handled from start to finish. And we are going to start talking about why immediately. Okay. Yeah. On the same day that the young woman's body was found, a couple of deputies found the missing flyer for Sasha Kraus. Although Sasha had disappeared from Farmington, a town about 260 miles away from Flagstaff, they noted that the victim's clothing, height, and hair matched the description of Sasha. Shortly after this discovery, the victim's identity was confirmed through fingerprints. It was 27-year-old Sunday school teacher Sasha Kraus. Sasha's parents were notified and an autopsy was performed on February 24th, just a couple of days after her body was discovered. The medical examiner found no obvious defensive wounds like scratches, bruises, or broken bones, which was likely because of the Mennonites' policy of non-resistance. The cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma to the head and an execution-style gunshot wound to the back of her head. The medical examiner retrieved a .22 caliber bullet from her head. There were no signs of sexual assault, and no additional DNA was discovered on or near her body. Though it is worth noting that the traditional Mennonite head covering was missing, as were her underwear. At least that's what I saw in certain...
That's suspicious. Mm-hmm. But there was no evidence of sexual assault.
No, there was not.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't see that in all the sources, so I will say take that with a grain of salt, but I did see it indicated that she was found without her underwear, and she was definitely found without her head covering, which, again, as a Mennonite woman, she would normally be wearing that anytime she was out in public. So, the police now had a body, but they still had no idea who would want to hurt Sasha. She was kind, respectful, and thoughtful. Though there were some vague suspicions floating around some people in the Farmington community, no one really had any idea of who would want to harm Sasha or why. Without a clear motive, police had to rely heavily on forensic evidence. The bullet was sent to a lab for more testing, and the Coconino Sheriff's Office requested Sasha's cell records, which had originally been collected by the San Juan County Sheriff's Office back in New Mexico. Based on this information, investigators were able to trace Sasha's whereabouts for a brief period of time on the night of her disappearance. On January 18th at 7:52 p.m., her phone pinged off a tower near the Lamp and Light compound in Farmington. This was predictable since we know that Sasha went to get the books from the church after 7 p.m. But then, at 8:58 p.m., the cell pinged off of a tower near the Four Corners region, which is about an hour west of Farmington and located along the route that a person would travel if they were going from Farmington to Sunset Crater National Monument. That ping at 8:58 p.m. was the last communication between Sasha's phone and any cell towers. As I said earlier, different Mennonite communities have different standards about the level of technology that they are allowed to use on a day-to-day basis. It's possible that her killer assumed that she didn't have a phone, but realized that she was carrying a cell partway through their trip. And then either turned it off, disposed of it, what have you. It's unclear if the phone was simply turned off or if it was destroyed or just discarded. It has never been found, but the digital trail still remains. Samuel Kuhn's phone records were subpoenaed, but he was quickly ruled out. His cell pinged off of a tower near the compound throughout the night. It also would have been difficult, if not impossible, for him to make it from Farmington to Sunset Crater Volcano and back again, and also be present for the search for Sasha at 4 o'clock in the morning. That just is that. It was a long way to travel. Without any other leads, the Coconino County Sheriff's Department decided to take a creatively brilliant new approach. They were able to obtain search warrants to compare cell ping records from all of the cell providers for all of the devices that would have gone from Farmington through the Four Corners region and into Sunset Crater Volcano National Monument on January 18th and 19th. Though thousands of cell records were examined, only one cell followed the same trail that Sasha was forced to take that evening.
How interesting.
And it is like, really interesting.
That is pretty cool that they were able to narrow it down like that.
This is why I say I have a lot of time for the Coconino Sheriff's Department.
Good on them. Very resourceful.
Those cell records were matched to a man named Mark Gooch. Because his last name is Gooch, I'm not going to be referring to him by his last name because I giggle every time I hear it. I understand. We all have funny last names, you know? That's just the way that things go. But, you know, he's going to be Mark from here on out because I can't handle that. Mark was a 21-year-old airman who specialized in equipment maintenance at Luke Air Force Base near Phoenix, Arizona. No one was able to establish a relationship between Mark and Sasha, but investigators soon learned that Mark had been raised on a farm in Wisconsin in a Mennonite community.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Detectives were sent to Wisconsin to talk to his old friends and family, and they learned that Mark had somewhat of a reputation in his small town. Oh. Neighbors and fellow Mennonites told investigators that Mark had a history of theft, vandalism, and was suspected of committing several burglaries before he left the area.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. As suspicions rose, Mark chose to leave the community and join the Air Force, which would have prohibited him from being a Mennonite due to their strongly held beliefs of non-resistance. Mm-hmm. No one could say why, but many people said that Mark seemed to hold a deep hatred for the Mennonite community in which he had been raised. His connection to and hatred for the Mennonite community provided more context between Mark Gooch and this crime. When they were approached by the Coconino County Sheriff's Office, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations agreed to help in this investigation. Since Mark lived on a military base, his movements on that base could be easily traced through CCTV footage. And in this case, that footage wouldn't be erased after a certain number of weeks. So that happens sometimes if it's just like gas station footage or something like that. But because he lives on an Air Force base, that footage is just going to keep on keeping on. Surveillance records showed Mark leaving the base at 9:04 a.m. on January 18th and heading north. Mark's cell phone pinged off of a tower near the Lamp and Light compound at 4:14 p.m. His phone continued to ping off of that same cell tower for the next 3 hours until after 7. Then, at 8:48 p.m., Mark's phone pinged off of a tower near the Four Corners region. Finally, at 1 a.m., his phone pinged off of a tower near Sunset Crater Volcano National Monument, where Sasha's body was later discovered. Cell phone records then indicate that he traveled back to the Air Force Base outside of Phoenix, and surveillance footage from the base shows him re-entering at 7 a.m. on January 19th. 2 days later, Mark's phone once again pinged off of a tower near Sunset Crater Volcano. Investigators were also able to obtain a search warrant for Mark's financial records, and they indicate that he stopped for gas in Farmington on the day of Sasha's disappearance. Mark was brought in for questioning by Detective Nagel in April of 2020. So again, this is relatively short order after the body was found. Again, good on them.
Impeccable.
Yeah, the police work on this is chef's kiss. Mark was respectful and cooperative, but he didn't answer the questions in a fully comprehensive way. Okay. Though he originally denied traveling out of Arizona at all, he finally admitted that he traveled to Farmington when he was confronted with his cell phone records. Mark told Detective Nagel that he swung by the church in Farmington at around 2 p.m. to check service times, but if he really wanted to attend church so badly, there were other Mennonite churches much closer to Phoenix.
Yeah. Did you see my very skeptical face? I did. You had to travel that far to find church. And also, like, you're going to consistently travel that far to go to services?
Right. No, I don't think so, buddy.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Detective Nagel also noted some discomfort when she asked him why he wasn't a member of the Mennonite community, and he said that he just really didn't like their way of life, which again
checking church services.
Again, yep, it begs the question, why was he there in the first place?
Yeah.
As the interview continued, Mark had a constantly evolving story as he was confronted about his timeline again and again. Finally, when Detective Nagel confronted him about Sasha's murder, Mark said that he wasn't responsible for her death and he asked for a lawyer. But at this point, they already had enough evidence for an arrest. So the reason that this interview was enough wasn't because he admitted to any wrongdoing, but while he was being questioned, police were searching his car based off of a search warrant that they had obtained. And while they searched his car, they found a pair of binoculars in the glove box, gloves in his trunk, and a receipt for a car detail service for February 23rd, which was the day after news of Sasha's discovery made the news.
Oh, like this is all speculation, but like he got paranoid and he was like, they're not going to find shit because I'm getting it cleaned out.
Yeah. I have to say, I don't know specifically what kind of gloves they are, but like having binoculars in the glove box isn't actually like as a person who comes from a outdoorsy family, I wouldn't think anything of somebody having binoculars.
Yeah.
Wildlife spotting.
Yeah.
Actual wildlife spotting, not being creepy.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't find the binoculars that weird. I do think depending on, like, what kind of gloves were in his car, it could be weird. Like, if they were, like, latex gloves, that's mm-hmm. a little bit odd. But, like, I have gloves in my car right now.
Like, working winter. Gloves. Like,
yeah. Or like, yeah. Or like,
mm-hmm. winter. Or, like, I have both. He's in the military. Like, he probably could have, like, working right. gloves in his car. But
right.
Not and making excuses for him, but, like,
no.
in normal circumstances.
That's exactly right. I think that if you look at it in the totality of all other evidence, it's like it's compelling in a way. But if I looked at those things as like individual pieces, they don't mean much to me. So mm-hmm. I just feel like that's worth pointing out. Before the arrest, the search warrant only allowed detectives to trace Mark's phone. But after his arrest, they were able to examine his calls and texts. Some texts were particularly damning. Mark had quite a few texts between him and his two brothers, both of whom had also chosen to leave the Mennonite community. His brother Samuel had gone into IT, and even though, you know, Mennonites are allowed to use a certain amount of modern day electronics and all that kind of stuff, IT is maybe taking it a step too far, and also I think that he was never baptized into the church, so he was like, no, I'm good, I'm out. Mm-hmm. And then Mark's other brother, Jacob, had become a state trooper, which obviously would not work with that whole non-resistance thing. Can't really adopt a policy of non-resistance if you want to be an effective state
right.
trooper.
So. Yeah.
Jacob texted Mark about a time that he had pulled over a group of Mennonites on their way to a wedding, and he coughed on them in the hopes that they would get COVID. Ugh. I know. People are gross. Mark
coughing on people in general is gross.
It's like, hideous. Yeah.
Let alone in the height of COVID.
Yeah. I, as a person who worked in elementary schools for many years, I have had many a person just sneeze, cough directly into my open mouth ugh. While I'm talking to them. Yay.
Anyway. I mean, yeah. And the only reason I gagged was because it was the thought of someone else's like non-child, like someone else's kid coughing into my, because like I think it's gross when my own kid coughs in my face,
yeah,
or sneezes in my face, but I can rationalize that a lot more than other people's children up in my grill, let alone grown-ass adults.
Yes, but you know, Mark actually praised his brother's actions and reported to both Jacob and Samuel that he had spent some time surveilling a few Mennonite communities in the weeks and months leading up to Sasha's murder.
And his brother wasn't like, I mean, man, that seems a little extra.
No.
I guess they have hard, hard negative feelings about it. If they're willing, if the officer brother's willing to cough into their face, hoping they get sick, mm-hmm. then I guess surveilling other communities isn't going to be out of the realm of possibility for that family.
Yeah. He never specifically, in text at least, he never specifically stated why he was surveilling these communities, and we can't confirm.
I'm just watching sure. them because it's mm-hmm. for funsies, like, still weird.
He did say something about, at one point, how a lot of the people in a lot of the communities that he was looking in on were older, and they had already, like, lived their whole miserable lives and stuff like that. So that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, just very sketchy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think like, that's at least true.
Foreboding? Is that, like, just ominous, mm-hmm. like, ominous statements mm-hmm. like that?
Very much so. Based on these texts, detectives now believe that Sasha's murder was premeditated. They now thought that Mark had surveilled the Lamp and Light community for several hours, and when he saw a chance to kidnap a young woman, he took it. He then forced her into his truck and drove her out to Sunset Crater Volcano, where he attacked and killed her. After Mark's arrest made the news, police were contacted by a worried friend and coworker of Mark. This friend told the police that Mark had asked him to hold a gun for him. That gun was handed over to the police and examined, and it was quickly determined to be connected to the crime. Mm-hmm. However, Mark didn't know that the police already had his weapon, so he stupidly asked his brother Samuel to come down and get it for him during one of his prison phone calls, because apparently neither one of them realized that these calls are monitored.
Is this not... This happened in what year again?
2020.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So very recent. Like,
yeah.
Is this not a common policy? I mean, this is a genuine question. Is this not a common policy across other states where if you're using a jail phone or a prison phone, it will say, this call may be monitored, or this call is monitored. Like, our jail system does that at the beginning of every call, and our clients know that.
I'm surprised that people wouldn't know that. I couldn't believe that there are some states that don't require that kind of full disclosure, and I believe that Oregon is one that does require it, and maybe Arizona is one that doesn't. I don't know.
I'm not saying it doesn't stop them from saying really dumb
stupid
things,
shit. Yeah,
but they know that they're being recorded.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
yeah.
I have
and
no
he
idea.
Could, he could know. He's just he, that.
Yeah.
That dumb.
Yeah, it's true. You know, as Justin from Generation Y would say, thank God for stupid criminals. So they also overheard Samuel giving Mark advice on how to erase his digital trail.
Holy moly.
Yep. Rather than confronting Mark or Samuel with this new evidence, they decided to set up a sting operation. Mark's friend was given a fake gun, and when he handed that gun over to Samuel, police flooded the scene and arrested him.
Samuel.
Yes. Not the friend. The friend was like, I just want everybody to know that I have a gun and I don't want anything to do with it anymore. Please come get it from me. I don't want to be party to any sort of criming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark's trial began 19 months after his arrest.
What did Samuel get arrested for? Like accessory to, or like,
I'm not entirely
betting, but like but hindering maybe. Hindering a case or something.
Yeah. I don't know.
Like hide the gun.
He was looking at 3 years prison time for his role in the crime, but he was offered a deal if he agreed to flip on his brother. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, which he did.
Yeah, I was going to say, did he? Because mm-hmm. he was the cop.
Samuel was the IT guy.
Oh, the IT guy.
Jacob was the cop.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mark's father, Jim Gooch, also testified against him in court, and he said that Mark, quote, lacked a converted heart, unquote.
His father at that point is still involved in the Mennonite community.
Yes, he is.
Like the sons, the brothers, they're all out of it, but.
All out.
Parents are still in it. Okay.
Yep, still very
and
much
obviously
part of it.
Is condemning their behavior.
Yeah, not a fan. Not a fan. Yeah. No. Mark's defense tried to raise doubt by mentioning another unknown vehicle that was seen near the Lamp and Light compound on the day of Sasha's abduction and pointing out the complete lack of physical evidence in this case, which there wasn't a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But the testimony from Mark's own family combined with the digital evidence was quite compelling. On October 13th, 2021, a jury found Mark guilty of murder, kidnapping, and theft. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Sasha's father, Bob Krause, told the Associated Press that Sasha was, quote, a person of deep faith who found joy in working with children and learning.
Yeah.
In 2010, Sasha wrote a poem titled, I Do Not Walk Alone. The last couple of stanzas say, in quietness, God's voice I hear, art thou alone while I am near? O foolish child, shake off thy fear. I do not walk alone. When stress and fear shall take their toll, when cruel tyrants grasp my soul, when death and all its horrors roll, I shall not walk alone.
That is profound. Some people just have a knack for it. Like, really profound words.
Yes. Some people do have a knack for really profound words. I do not.
No.
No. No, 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 no.
Same.
That is the case of Sasha Kraus. And unfortunately, there isn't really a sense of closure, I think, mm-hmm. here. And, you know, there's the closure of knowing what happened. And I guess there's not really closure.
Does he still, to this day, stand on the fact that he did not do it? It's just lots of circumstantial, mostly circumstantial evidence.
As far as I can tell, he is still standing by his original story. And all things considered, you know, whether he did it or he didn't do it, the lack of physical evidence is probably enough that, like, unless he has a complete change of heart and decides to confess to something that he was charged and convicted of, then he really doesn't have necessarily a reason to admit to anything. He's not going to be able to earn parole because he was given life without the possibility. Oh, so yeah. Again, he has no reason to admit to anything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just it seems as though it's a very random crime. They're mm-hmm. the only connection genuinely between Mark and Sasha is that they were both raised in a Mennonite community.
Yeah.
And that was it. They didn't live in the same state. They weren't from the same community. They didn't even know the same people, as far as I can tell. They just both were raised Mennonite, and that was it.
Yeah, it seemed like a very impulsive, like, opportunistic crime. Like, she just happened to be there. I would like to know, like, where he was where was he going?
Yeah, I think that the thing that I think that the reason that this case feels kind of just unresolved, even though we have a pretty good idea of who did it, because I do think that Mark Gooch was responsible for this crime. I just don't know who else it would have been.
Right.
But, you know, there are so many unanswered questions because it's kind of like, did he always plan to murder somebody and he was just waiting for the right victim? Was he going around to these different Mennonite communities to surveil them just out of, like, weird spitefulness and to just get, like, more and more angry about whatever bullshit he was on?
Yeah.
Or was he surveilling them because he was looking for the, you know, quote unquote, right victim? And I just don't know. And unless he ever, you know, says anything about it, it's going to be really hard to figure out why that would happen. And of course, you know, you don't really truly need to know why, but it is very odd.
It provides a lot of closure, I think, for, like, family and...
Yeah.
Like, even if it's not a good reason, it's a reason other than, like, you're just a random, terrible person. Like, you were troubled or, like, I don't know.
Yeah. I think so, because in some ways I think that just the complete unpredictability of somebody committing a murder of somebody that they don't know and they don't have any connection to is so unsettling mm-hmm. in particular. I think that that's very, very scary to think about. So there's that. And then I also have a lot of questions about why Mark, Jacob, and Samuel all left the Mennonite community. Yeah. I think that, you know, it might have been some stupid reason. Like, they were really just annoying teens who ended up in, like, this brotherly group think where they think that they were, like, abused as children because they weren't allowed to use, I don't know, Facebook or something. I have no idea, you know? I don't know because we just don't know
right
enough.
Or, but like, I mean, there could be a lot of layers, like, the stereotype of, like, the super religious parents who at home are, like, hard child beaters and causes a lot of trauma like that. And I think it kind of goes back to what I was saying before, where, like, Mennonites don't ever come off as people who, like, are hypocritical, people who don't practice what they preach. They genuinely have a sense of, like, connection to their religion and to their mm-hmm. word, where, like, most, they're not, like, who you initially think of as targets for, like, violence like that. But if those brothers specifically were targeting that group for some reason, maybe there is some, like, rooted trauma there that we don't know about.
Yeah. I guess it just, and then for me, again, it begs the question because, like, sometimes, you know, people I know people at least who think that they have had like really traumatic childhoods because their parents just didn't give them everything that they wanted. Mm-hmm. And then people who actually had traumatic childhoods. So, you know, those are two very different things. And I don't know which one it was for those brothers.
Right.
So anyway, I'm still left with a lot of questions, a lot of wonderings, a lot of sadness and frustration.
Yeah. On the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I am glad that there's closure and like there was a body that was found. Family got to be able to have that service for her, because the one specifically where like there's like suspects, but not really good ones, or like the body still isn't found. Those are very discouraging.
Yeah. I think that this had every opportunity to become a cold case. Mm-hmm. And the only reason it didn't is because there were a lot of really dedicated investigators working on this case. And again, kudos to everybody who, you know, contributed, because it was
personally, I think the cell phone tower thing was like genius, genius work. That's the type of stuff where like I see in like movies and I'm like, is that even really possible? Is that like, feels like a lot of data, a lot of work.
Yeah, it feels like a CSI episode or something like that, but like in a good way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very well done. So anyway, that is this week's case. And next week we are going to be back with another true crime case. No. And next week we're going to be back with another paranormal episode. We're going to be talking about something that is very much everybody listening has heard of it. I would stake my reputation on that. I don't have a reputation, so I'm not staking very much on that. And so we are going to be diving into that next week. And until next time, bye.
Goodbye.
If you liked the show, please leave us a great review and don't forget to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Wicked Within Podcast.